was Vrishadashva, and his son was Ratitara. Ratitara had no sons, but when he requested the favor of the great sage Angira, the sage begot several sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. When the sons were born, they became the dynasty of Angira Rishi and of Ratitara. The son of Manu was Ikshvaku, who had 100 sons, of whom Bikukshi, Nimi, and Dadaka were the eldest. The sons of Maharaj Ikshvaku became kings of different parts of the world. Because of violating sacrificial rules and regulations, one of these sons, Bikukshi, was banished from the kingdom. By the mercy of Vashishta and the power of mystic yoga, Maharaj Ikshvaku attained liberation after giving up his material body. When Maharaj Ikshvaku expired, his son, Bikukshi, returned and took charge of the kingdom. He performed various types of sacrifices, and he was pleased, and he pleased the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This Bikukshi later became celebrated as Sashada. Bikukshi's son fought with the demons for the sake of the demigods. And because of his valuable service, he became famous as Purangjaya. Indravaha I Katukshta. The son of Puranjaya was Anina, the son of Anina was Pitu, and the son of Pitu was Vishwagandhi. The son of Vishwagandhi was Chandra, and the son of Chandra was Yuvanashva, and his son was Shavatsa, who constructed the Shavasti Puri. The son of Shravasta was Brihadashva. Brihadashva's son was Kubalayashva. Brihadashva's son Kubalayashva killed a demon named Dhundu, and thus he became celebrated as Dhundu Mara, the killer of Dhundu. The sons of the killer of Dhundu were Vidashva, Kapilashva, and Bhadrashva. He also had thousands of other sons, but they burned to ashes in the fire emanating from Dhundu. The son of Dhudashva was Haryashva, and the son of Haryashva was Nikumba. The son of Nikumba was Bahulashva, and the son of Bahulashva was Krishashva. The son of Krishashva was Senajit, and his son was Yuvanashva. Yuvanashva married 100 wives, but he had no sons, and therefore he entered the forest. In the forest, the sages performed a sacrifice known as Indra-yajna on his behalf. Once, however, the king became so thirsty in the forest that he drank the water kept for performing yajna. Consequently, after some time, a son came forth from the right side of his abdomen. The son, who was very beautiful, was crying to drink breast milk, and Indra gave the child his index finger to suck. Thus the son became known as Mandaka. In due course of time, Yuvanashva achieved perfection by performing austerities. Thereafter, Mandhata became the emperor and ruled the earth, which consists of 7 islands. Thieves and rogues were very much afraid of this powerful king, and therefore the king was known as Shrasadasu, meaning one who is very fearful to rogues and thieves. Mandatta begot sons in the womb of his wife Bindumati. These sons were Purukutsa, Ambarisha, and Muchukunda. These 3 sons had 50 sisters, all of whom became the wives of the great sage known as Saubhari. In this connection, Shukadeva Goswami described the history of Saubhari Muni, who, because of sensual agitation caused by fish, fell from his yoga and wanted to marry all the daughters of Mandatta for sexual pleasure. Later, Saubari Muni became very regretful. Thus he accepted the order of Vanaprastha, performed very severe austerities, and thus attained perfection. In this regard, Shukadeva Goswami described how Saubari Muni's wives also became perfect. So we'll begin the chapter, reading text number 1. Oh, technology. Maybe we'll repeat text number 2, because that's the one that has a small purport. So I'll just read text number 1 in the translation, then we can repeat. Is that possible with this projection? Okay, good. Shishuku vacha virupa kituman chambur ambarisha sutastraya virupa prasadhasvo bhut tat putras tat vratitara. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Shukadeva Goswami said, O Maharaj Parikshit, Ambarisha had 3 sons named Virupa, Ketuman, and Shambhu. From Virupa came a son named Prashadashva, and from Prashadashva came a son named Ratitar. Text number 2, everyone can please repeat. Ratitarasya Prajasya Varyayam Tantavertita Angira Janayamasa Brahmavarchasvina Sutan Tatitarasya Prajasya Varyayam Tantavertita Angira Janayamasa Brahmavarchasvina Sutan Tatitarasya Prajasya Varyayam Tantavertita Angira Janayamasa Brahmavarchasvina Sutan. Etarasya Prajasa Brahmavarchasvina. Who had Brahminical qualities. Sutan. Sons. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Pratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons into the womb of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with Brahminical prowess. Please repeat. Pratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons into the womb of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with Brahminical prowess. Purport. In the Vedic age, a man was sometimes called upon to beget sons in the womb of a lesser man's wife for the sake of better progeny. In such an instance, the woman is compared to an agricultural field. A person possessing an agricultural field may employ another person to produce food grains from it, but because the grains are produced from the land, they are considered the property of the owner of the land. Similarly, a woman was sometimes allowed to be impregnated by someone other than her husband. But the sons born of her would then become her husband's sons. Such sons were called Kshatrajata. Because Pratitara had no sons, he took advantage of this method. Om Jnana Tibarandasyam Ganam Jana Sharakaya Chakshurummilitam Vinatasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupakatam Maham Dharatishwa Paramukam Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaudavani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastyapadishatarine Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siya Dvaita Garadha Shibashari Gaur Vaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So, just as a little side point, the Aparjasya, he had no sons. This is a very common thing that happened. Chitraketu, Dasharat, it was very common that sometimes a king, even though these were very powerful and potent kings, sometimes by destiny there would be no son. So here we're speaking about Srila Prabhupada in his purport, the Vedic system. So the Vedic system is based on certain principles, and those principles, like we see here, of course the basic principle is that a wife a woman should have a husband, and she should be very chaste and faithful to that husband. But even a higher Vedic principle was, especially for a king, that the kingdom had to be continued, the dynasty. Just like we read in the Bhagavatam in the first canto, that when Parikshit Maharaj was in the womb, everyone was raised concerned, because if somehow or another Parikshit Maharaj was not fully qualified, he was the last descendant. And as Srila Prabhupada had said again and again and again, that if you don't have a qualified king, then government will be very difficult. Although we live in a democratic society, or a supposed democratic society, we can see the results. As Srila Prabhupada said, democracy can only function to some degree among Brahmins, qualified persons. And the best system is to have qualified kings. Therefore, especially kings would follow this formula. If they had no kings and also Brahmins, Kshatriyas and Brahmins, they would follow this system. If there was no qualified son, it was more important to continue the dynasty than to follow a Vedic rule. So this is also reflected in Vaishnava Dharma, that as Vaishnavas, we have certain principles, but there are higher principles. And the highest principle, we always should work according to the highest principle. With Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu demonstrated this when he took sannyas. Now this particular principle, according to Brahma Bhagavata Purana, this principle that is being spoken about here is prohibited in Kali Yuga. Dharuyena sutot patim, that a son, that in this age, one's brother, and what to speak of a sage or somebody else, a more qualified person, is not allowed to have it, because in Kali Yuga, that would very easily be misinterpreted, and we could have even a more difficult social complications than we have already. So with husbands, wives, families, and all these things, there's been a little trying in this age of Kali at this point, juncture in time. And also, sannyas. Sannyas is prohibited. Five things. Kalo pancha vibhar jayat. Five things are prohibited. And sannyas is another thing. Gaur Srila Prabhupada explains, this means mayavadi sannyas. But even Srila Prabhupada commented in several different lectures. He said, now we experience that sometimes it is very difficult. We have given sannyas to young men, but we experienced that it's very difficult. So these things are, of course, this particular thing cannot be done in Kali Yuga. But sannyas, because of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is another great acharya's example, we can understand that sannyas can be given very carefully. And we can understand the principle there is that that this type of Vedic sannyas will be very difficult in Kali Yuga. And of course there's other prohibitions like horse sacrifice, cow sacrifice, offering flesh to the forefather. All these things in Kali Yuga would be very difficult. The whole purpose of Lord Buddha's appearance was because of not following this principle. People were offering flesh to the forefathers and animals and sacrifice, and this can't be done in Kali Yuga. So, but the higher principle in this particular case, which was before Kali Yuga, was that he was a great king. So a great king has a responsibility. Of course, in the Mahabharata, our Pandavas came about by this same process. And their fathers came about by this same process. Because the principle was, in the case of Ambika, Ambalika, was that their husband had died, and who would carry on this great Kuru dynasty? Carrying on the great Kuru dynasty was more important than, Ambika's lamentation that her husband had died, and Satyavati's insistence that Bhima should forget about his vow and carry on the dynasty. But his higher principle was to follow the truth. So then, she had to reveal her previous situation with Vyasadeva, that he was actually her son and that he could carry on the dynasty. And he did so. And therefore, Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and Bidura came about. And because of Pandu's curse, which is actually brought about, that's an interesting thing, because it was, Pandu was a great devotee of the Lord. But because of the mode of passion, he became overwhelmed in his hunting. He was very fond of hunting, being a very powerful king and the most expert archer of his day. He was very fond of hunting. He had to conquer so many things. By the time he became king, there were many rebellious kings who had arisen and were creating a disturbance and a threat to the ongoing Kuru dynasty. So he had to very vigilantly overpower these kings and reestablish the power of the Kuru dynasty. So in that, passion, he was hunting and he saw a deer. So natural that a kshatriya sees a deer. He was so anxious to kill the deer that he didn't take into account that the deer was mating. And because of that, he was cursed. And therefore, the mode of passion, even for pure devotees, can be very dangerous. Just like Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj was such a great devotee of the Lord. Such a great devotee that he was personally blessed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, giving him the blessing to be a great king. But still, he was overcome by the mode of passion. So every devotee has to be very careful. The Bhagavatam begins by warning us about these modes of nature and even the mode of goodness can be very dangerous, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, because the mode of goodness has the tendency to make us feel very self-satisfied, very confident. So unless the mode of goodness is elevated to Vishuddha Sattva, the mode of pure transcendental goodness, then what can we actually, we can be easily overcome by the mode of passion. So these situations, even in Vedic times, to avoid the mode of passion, sometimes in Krishna consciousness, in our enthusiasm, being many people in the neophyte stage, they think that because I've started chanting Hare Krishna, because this is something that many of us experience, I've started chanting Hare Krishna, I'm already on the perfectional stage. And we don't take into account all of the Vaishnav Tantra, all of the Vaishnav rules and regulations, all of the Vaishnav stipulations to be, all the things that are put there by all of our acharyas, by Srila Prabhupada, to make sure that the mode of passion, and what to speak of the mode of ignorance, don't interfere with our devotional service. And even though we may cultivate devotional service in the mode of goodness, that we don't become attached to the mode of goodness. We become attached to serving Krishna. So, really, everything boils down to having the proper motive. This is, in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, the first answer to the questions of the sages of Naimisharanya is Sabhaipum Samparo Dharmo Yato Bhakti Dhoksache Ahaituki Pratiyata. A devotional service to be pure and to be perfect and to satisfy the self. Otherwise there'll be hankering. And hankering means that we will fall into the modes of nature. So to avoid hankering, that the motive, ahaituki, there has to be the only motive of pleasing Krishna, and yapatiyata. And not only does the motive have to be there, but the constant execution of devotional service has to be there. And of course, motives are spoken about again and again. This word ahaituki comes up again and again, especially Lord Kapila Dev. He speaks two very beautiful verses in his teachings to his mother, where he says that devotional service is unstoppable. If one madguna shruti matrena, if one actually hears with great attention the Lord who is situated in the heart, my sarvaguhashaye, I am situated in the heart of everyone, and if one hears about my transcendental qualities, then manogatir avichina, then the mind can actually be controlled, because the mind will acquire great strength by the attraction to Krishna, by the attraction to me, who I'm already there in the heart, I'm available. Krishna is saying, Akulor Kapila Dev is saying, I'm available to all of you. I'm in the heart, I'm right there, I'm the first, most available person. And that devotional service will be so powerful, just like itag gangam vasom buddhau, just like the flowing of the Ganga. Who can stop the Ganga? Of course, nowadays they have many dams on the Ganga. But still, you can't stop the Ganga. Of course, if Kali Yuga continues like it is, they continue filtering it off into canals here and there, then that's the only way they could actually do it, by irrigation. They're actually able to put some dams on the Ganga. But the point is, the devotional service is so powerful that a great river like the Ganga represents its power. Nothing can stop it. So he says that for devotional service to have that effect, it must be nirgunasya bahu udahitam. It must be free from any tinge of the modes of material nature. And it must be ahaituki. It must be unmotivated. And avyayahita, unadulterated. Very direct, very powerful. And then devotional service will manifest within the heart of the devotee. So, this understanding of motivation. The motive is the first thing that we have to work on. And then all the details that are given by our acharyas. If our motive is pure, then it will be very easy to follow these details. You know, all the detail, how to perform devotional service, how to execute devotional service. The determination, the perseverance, and the ability to perform the necessary austerities and penances that nurture the cultivation of our devotional service will according to, of course, every one of those things is according to our position. If we're vanaprastha, if we're sannyasi, if we're grihastha, brahmachari, you know, or even some of the newer categories, you know, that nowadays have kind of evolved, you know, that haven't been really defined. Maybe we have to redefine some, put in some extra categories here. They're already there, you know, just have to give them, label them. So, but everything, but every one of any position that we may be in, from any position, we have to go forward in devotional service. So this principle is being illustrated in this particular purport by Srila Prabhupada, that the highest principle of devotional service has to be the main motivating force, and that highest principle is to please Krishna. In the talks between Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy, you know, this idea, this concept becomes very clear. Of course, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after he met Ramananda Roy, they arranged a second meeting where they would discuss. Because in the first meeting there was interruption. Because when there are people who are not qualified, even in the when the sages of Naimisharanya, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, when they all came together in Naimisharanya, Shukadeva Goswami had to be very careful how he spoke. And this is the main reason why he didn't mention the name of Radha. Because there were people in the audience that who couldn't understand the... So he had to be a little indirect. Of course, there are other reasons. There's always many reasons for great saintly persons. But he had to be very careful, you know, that these, you know, great sages, mystic yogis and everything, if he simply began to, in explanations of the 10th canto, because very early in the explanations of the 10th canto, comes Vrindavan Leela. And within Vrindavan Leela unfolds the glories of Srimati Radharani. So he had to explain those glories, but he explained them in the context of the gopis, and then this one very special gopi. And even then, Shukadeva Goswami, you know, his explanation was expanded by the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, so that the Gaudiya Vaishnavas could have a real full understanding of Krishna's position, because this was the understanding given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So even in Naimisharanya, there was certain care taken how Krishna consciousness is presented to the general audience. And when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu met with Ramananda Roy, the brahmanas who were totally bewildered, here is this, you know, effulgent sannyasi, and here's this governor, you know, and they're embracing one another. You know. Why would this sannyasi embrace this low class, you know, according to their estimation, this lower class person? So they had to arrange another meeting, and in that meeting, immediately Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, as we see again and again, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he could easily have arranged everything, and he later on informed Arjuna, actually I've done everything, I've already arranged everything, but I want you to do it. You know? I want you to be victorious. I want you to be glorified. I want my devotee to be glorified. So also Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You know? In this sense, Ramananda Roy in that particular meeting was partially empowered by Arjuna with this particular sentiment of being the glorified devotee. being the one who actually becomes victorious and presents devotional service. So he said, please tell me, what is the goal of life? And he gave an explanation. First explanation, Varnashram. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu immediately rejected. This is external. Because there are too many ulterior motives. In Varnashram, very easily, and of course, Srila Prabhupada explains, especially in Kali Yuga, because of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this conversation took place in Kali Yuga only 500 years ago, so well into Kali Yuga. The Varnashram system, even under any circumstances, cannot produce pure devotional service in and of itself. But what to speak of in Kali Yuga? Varnashram is very difficult, as we've all seen again and again, that it's a difficult thing to do. And so immediately Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejected that. So then he proposed, well, then you serve Krishna. Yat kuroshi adashnasi, yat judasi didasi yat. You serve Krishna and offer the fruits of your activities to Krishna. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejected, this is karma yoga. It's good, but this is not, you have to go on, this is not sufficient. And then he proposed, what is what we know as the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. Sarvadhamam padicca jamam ekam sharanam raja. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejected that. Now one can say, how can surrender to Krishna? How can one reject surrender to Krishna? This is such a wonderful motive. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw that even if you padityaja, even if you renounce so many things, that can also be external. You may renounce this and that and this and that, and you may serve Krishna, but there still may be ulterior motives. So then, Ramananda Roy, he thought, and he said, well, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma na shuchati na kamshati. Well, then the way to get to Mad Bhaktir Labhate Param, the way to get to devotional service, according to Krishna, is Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma. Because there is no involvement in the material energy. So, again, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu considered that this is good. This is beyond material contamination. But this doesn't reach Vaikuntha. Doesn't take you to Vaikuntha, what to speak of Krishna Loka. So, and this is actually one of the greatest obstacles for people who follow the yoga process or follow some other process. Because, they feel, as soon as you feel, actually Srila Prabhupada mentions also in when Lord Chaitanya is explaining to Rupa Goswami the process of becoming, of ascending to Goloka Vrindavan, at some point you come into contact with the Brahma Jyoti. And one can actually feel satisfied, because na shochati na kamshati. There's no more lamentation. There's no more hankering. So one may feel very satisfied at that point and may not have the impetus to go on to the lotus feet of Krishna. So that is the danger there. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejected. And finally, Ramananda Roy was able to satisfy him by Janai Prayasam Udapasyana Manteva, that when you go beyond jnana, when you go beyond the bodily activities offered to Krishna, but there can still be some ulterior motive, or even the mental activities, you're offering it, but there may be some ulterior. But when you give up the whole process of jnana, not that we don't employ jnana in the service of Krishna, but first there has to be the purity of only wanting to surrender and to serve Krishna, and then jnana can become the servant of that. Otherwise jnana can be very dangerous, as the Bhagavatam confirms. Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha Janayat Yasu Vairagyam Jnana Chayada Dukam, that jnana will come automatically, and vairagya, detachment, will come automatically from devotional service. Of course, Srila Prabhupada explained many times that jnana and vairagya can complement devotional service. Or if they're there before devotional service and one takes up devotional service, they can help devotional service to manifest more quickly. But they in themselves are not a requisite for devotional service. The requisite for devotional service is not something that I acquire, that I attain, but it's when Krishna's mercy descends through the Vaishnava. And that is the only way, when that mercy descends through the Vaishnavas, that we can actually feel that, you know, that there, the possibility that there's no motive. You know. Just like Srila Prabhupada, in so many instances, you know, he wanted to weed out the motivations of his disciples, who had good motivations. You know. Just like one time, that Hari Shorty Prabhu relates that when he was serving, he was very new, he was only been there for a couple of months, and he was serving Srila Prabhupada. So the cook was a little late because the cook was sick. You know, sometimes Srila Prabhupada was traveling. Even in the best of circumstances, when Srila Prabhupada was traveling so much, the servants couldn't keep up with him. Even though they were young men, healthy, and Prabhupada was an older man, certain health complications, because of his pure devotion, he just kept going, and the servants were kind of dragging behind. So, and what to speak of when they were in India. You know. So the cook was behind, and so he was very concerned that Prabhupada's not getting his prasadam. Let me go down and figure out what's going on, get the prasadam, get the plate up there. So he left, and right when he left, Prabhupada began to ring the bell. And he rang the bell, and he rang the bell again, and he rang the bell again. And he rang them for 10 minutes. He rang the bell like every 30 seconds. And then, you know, finally somebody came down and told Hari Shori, Prabhupada's ringing the bell, you better go up and find out what's happened. You know? So he ran up there, and Srila Prabhupada was so angry that his lips were quivering, and said, "You rascal, why don't you answer? I've been ringing the bell for 10 minutes, you know." And he said, "Prabhupada, I was just getting your prasada." He said, "I don't want that prasada. No, take it away. Forget about it. No. Why are you, know?" So Prabhupada chastised him again and again. So even though his motive was apparently pure, he had to understand what is the most important thing, what is the order in which things should be considered. So even sometimes we may, within our own heart, or even within our own desire, our motive may be very good. If that motive is not matured by the proper understanding, how will I please the spiritual master? How will I serve the spiritual master in the best way, or Krishna? You know, it's such a science, devotional service. How to do things in the proper way, how to have the proper motive, how to make it constant. You know, so many considerations. So Srila Prabhupada chastised, he became so angry. And later on, Hari Shorty, he himself began to meditate on motives. You know, because sometimes Srila Prabhupada, as many of us experience, would become very angry. You know. But then one could see in Srila Prabhupada's case, there was no motive. Because immediately when the lesson was there, then Prabhupada would smile. And it's forgotten, gone, it's finished. So, Srila Prabhupada wanted to make sure in his brief time with us that our motives would become pure. Krishna himself, you know, would measure the motives of different persons. Just like when Krishna came into Mathura. You know, so the first person he met in Mathura after meeting up with Nanda Maharaj and, you know, coming into the city and seeing the ladies and on the balcony greeting them and everything. Then he met the washerman. So what was his motive? Pride, you know, contempt, service to the wrong person. Everything was wrong. So Krishna, you know, after he spouted off his insults, then Krishna just took his fingers, you know, as it says, Anganiyasya Sakalendriya Vittimandri, any part of his body can perform any function. He can cut off a head with his fingers, doesn't need a sword or anything. So, finished him off. And then the next person he met was a weaver. And what was his motive? His motive was, he saw Krishna's beauty, and he was attracted to that beauty. And he was, he didn't really know Krishna, but he saw that Krishna was very wonderful. And so he weaved him some very nice things to go along with the clothes that Krishna and Balaram had chosen from King's wardrobe. And so Krishna blessed him. Immediately he blessed him. You will have great fortune, you will have health, you will have prosperity, and after that, you will have liberation. So he was very happy. Then the next person he met, further, less motivation, no motivation, was Sudam, the garland maker. So he saw Krishna, he was overwhelmed. He understood who was Krishna. He understood immediately. And so Krishna says, he could understand what Krishna wanted. Krishna wanted a garland. So this is first class. Without even being told, without any instruction, without any request, he made a beautiful garland for Krishna and Balaram. And so Krishna said, whatever you want, you can have. And what was his response? I simply want to serve you. I simply want to be engaged in your devotional service. He didn't ask for anything. And instead, Krishna gave him, he said, you will get prosperity and you will always be with me. You will always be with me. After this lifetime, you will eternally be with me. Because no motivation. So no motivation assures us of having the possibility of entering into Krishna's service, engaging in Krishna's service, and being fixed in devotional service. Just like one time, Srila Prabhupada was explaining in a class about one verse in the Bhagavatam, famous verse in the Bhagavatam, Kechit Kavalaya Bhaktya Vasudeva Parayanaha. That there are so many ways that you can advance through so many Vedic processes. But for those rare persons who really understand the purport, the essence of devotional service, just unalloyed devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If they can, those rare persons who can understand that, all obstacles are cleared away. So the question came up in that class that, what about if one commits some offense? So Srila Prabhupada answered that even if one commits an offense, if one is very sincere and determined to perform devotional service, understands the danger of offenses and tries to avoid those offenses, then through his sincerity, Krishna will reveal the path of devotional service, keep him on the path of devotional service, and he will overcome those offenses and achieve pure devotional service. So this understanding of not having a motivation, there may be so many obstacles. We may be inclined to some offense due to our conditioning. We may have some weakness due to our conditioning. But if we keep our motives pure by associating with pure souls, with devotees who are very determined to serve Krishna. Last night I was speaking with a few devotees and trying to emphasize that point. And especially all of you here in Alachua, you're so fortunate. You have so much association. So many opportunities, so many advanced devotees, so many senior devotees, so much opportunity for association. We just have to take advantage of it. Because there's so many devotees that don't have that advantage. They're out in the middle of nowhere, or everybody around them is just as new or newer than they are. So what is their association? So having this advantage is so wonderful. But taking advantage of it, this is the real key to success in devotional service. So, just to go back to the original point, and I'll stop because it says here that there's a time frame. Everybody has so many services to do. Srila Prabhupada was always very conscious of this, you know. Generally speaking, he spoke about a half an hour. Generally speaking, sometimes he spoke a little more, sometimes a little less, a little more, but he was very conscious of the need for service, you know, in our lives. But going back to the point of doing, taking the highest path in devotional service, that if we're in this situation, we shouldn't, of having nice association, beautiful deities, a wonderful, you know, mandir, and but if we don't take advantage of it, then we don't, you know, although what we're doing, we may be at home, we may have our deities at home, we may chant our rounds, but if we don't take advantage of the highest opportunity to perform devotional service on the most elevated level, then some, that inability or lack of desire to push on and on. I just yesterday, when I found out what this verse was, I just looked back to a few purports in the previous chapter, and Srila Prabhupada mentions in one of his purports that one has to perform more and more and more and more service. You know? And of course, that means chanting, that means hearing, that means whatever our service may be. Otherwise, we have to always be anxious. We have to always be desirous of improving, of progressing. Because devotional service is not stagnant. It can never be stagnant. And if our service becomes stagnant, then what will happen? Maya will enter. The external energy will enter. Obstacles of devotional life will enter very quickly, because Maya is also, she's empowering, you know, our whole environment outside of the community is empowered by Maya, and it's very easy to get caught up in that. So if we don't take advantage of the higher principle, association with the Vaishnavas, increasing our devotional service at every step, you know, being very careful to do these things, then offenses can creep in, inattentiveness can creep in to of our service, of our rounds, and so many things. And then we get stuck, you know, and we don't go for this higher principle, which is being mentioned here. Then it will be very easy to become influenced by Maya or by inattentiveness to our service, and then there'll be so many obstacles. So anyway, these are some thoughts that I had on these particular verses. Certainly most of you, being more advanced than me, have many more thoughts, but I'll stop here. Are there any comments or questions? Mahatma Prabhu?
You already have sort of answered the question I'm going to ask, so I'm trying to dig a little deeper.
Okay.
So bear with me. I'm not clear. It seems that for some devotees, the motive that gets in the way is the motive to be recognized, or take it a step further, to be honored. And sometimes that can be behind one's enthusiasm. One's enthusiastic, or because they're going to be honored, or because they're being honored, or because they can get the honor, and they'll even be a little calculative about how to do that. For what you're saying about motives, the thought came to my mind, or the conundrum came to my mind, that in one sense it seems that we are being told to have the right motives, that we do have control over our motives. The other side of the equation seems that due to past samskara and karma, we have certain conditioning which is directing our motives. So my question is, do we actually have control, or is there a limitation to how much we can control our motives based on our conditioning, that we are a certain way? Sometimes you'll find devotees, for example, will say something like, I'm not this way. or perhaps expressing something even within the modes of nature, and you can see that they're not taking the initiative to, they're kind of surrendering to the way they are. So could you explain how much the motive is our choice, and is it entirely our choice, or is there some conditioning that is blocking us from having the pure motive? And is it therefore then by the process of bhakti that the pure motive will come, the mercy of guru and sadhus that it will come, and we have to wait? It's a combination of both. Or could we immediately just say, no, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it for the right motive, and do it for the right motive?
That's a very good question, and a very good point. Yes, it's not just our choice. As you say very correctly, that conditioning is very strong. And therefore, I mentioned association. Because only by association of persons who are more advanced than us, can our motives be revealed. Not only our motives, but our attachments. Just like I many times give the example that, as far as one's purity of purpose, just like if we talk about following the four regulative principles, it's very easy to see if I'm following them or not. No, it's not like you think, am I drinking this beer or am I not? No, it's not it's very clear. But as far as pride, as you say, pride, desire for recognition, these things are very subtle. And our motive can appear to us to be very pure. I just want to serve Krishna. And like you say, it can even be an impetus to doing a lot of service or to doing a lot of, making a great effort and having a lot of determination. So therefore, the secret of purity is association with persons who are more advanced. At least that there are contemporaries who can recognize motives. Of course, the contemporaries have to have the purity in associating with one another to not impose their, indicate the motive of another person in such a way that it agitates their false ego. Rather, we have to associate with those persons or that can help us understand our motives, but and again, we have to be desirous that that happens. Otherwise, we'll just start judging that person. Why are they criticizing me? Don't they understand? Who are they? And so, therefore, a lot of association is necessary. And with the devotees who are hopefully more advanced than us, sometimes that may not be possible. But therefore, we have the Bhagavatam, we have the holy name, and combining that with association, then our impure motives can become revealed. But then the desire for that revelation has to be there. Otherwise, one will isolate oneself or have a conception of that other person who's trying to help you understand that they perceive a motive, and then it just becomes a war rather than a association, war of false egos. So that's why I mentioned association. That's how I understand that association is so important, because it reveals the motive. Right. Yes.
Maharaj, thank you for your class. Very enjoyable and enlightening.
Thank you for your inspiration.
You mentioned about particularly not associating with the mode of passion and not even goodness, that we should be on a transcendental level towards the beginning of your class.
We have to do that through goodness. Use the instrument of goodness.
Sometimes when you do a service, as we can experience, if you're in, go into a management position, then you, there's a lot of passionate activities, or if you're expanding or building or trying to do a project or build a temple or expand, there's a lot of passion. If you go out on book distribution, where you're in the cities or the airports, there's a tendency to have a lot of passionate activity. So can you reconcile not associating with the modes of nature and performing some activity in devotional service which seems to utilize the modes of nature? For example, Arjuna fighting, where Krishna inspired his anger in order for him to fight.
Yes. Actually, just you mentioned Arjuna. I was going to use the example of Arjuna, that Arjuna was guided by Krishna, you know, and therefore he could use that immense passion in a purified state. You know. Just like the other day we were talking about mercury in Ayurveda. It's so dangerous. It's a poison. But if you know how to boil it and cook it properly, then it becomes one of the most powerful medicines. You know. So, of course, the mode of passion can be very dangerous, and therefore one who engages in activities which require passion also requires that they associate and they take guidance, you know, from persons who are in the mode of goodness. I mean, that's just the Vedic system. Kings, when you're a king or when you're doing a kingly duty, you have to take guidance and association and instruction, indications, and, you know, ask questions. Even Srila Prabhupada would ask his disciples, what do you think about this? Of course, he may have done that just to instruct us, but he gave us the example that whenever you're doing something through that association, you can be careful, you can take care that, you know, it's not just my idea, or I'm not being governed by the mode of passion and, you know, overcome by the mode of passion. So anytime, you know, and passion is very necessary to get things done, and Srila Prabhupada structured this movement in such a way to get things done. You know. So we have to have people of brahminical nature around us if we're in that position that we can associate with, and they can keep our passion properly directed, you know, it doesn't overcome us. So if you have to do something very passionate, it's very good to associate with persons who are brahminical. And they will indicate, Prabhu, be careful. Maharaj, be careful. What about this? What about be careful? So that's necessary. I didn't speak too much about the mode of ignorance because hopefully none of us are acting in that mode. No. I think it's pretty obvious when you're in that mode that you're there. If you have some knowledge of devotional service. Usually people who are in the mode of ignorance are just overcome. Of course, sometimes we can become angry. That's the most dangerous contact with the mode of ignorance, anger, that sometimes overcomes us. But generally speaking, it's identifiable. If one is a little bit advanced in devotional service, they can identify this is the danger zone, mode of ignorance. I have one question back here. And you can just cut me off if I'm violating the, you know. Otherwise, it's beyond 8:45, so everybody's free to go. From this point on, it's voluntary process.
I too wanted to thank you for your class. It's very wonderful points you made. I have a statement. I want to just make some point that was referred by Maha, and then ask a question. We were studying yesterday the Krishna Samvit, and in relationship to essay written by Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and then coupled it with the Krishna book, and it's on the 18 obstacles he wrote on the 18 obstacles of performing or developing one's bhakti. And in each obstacle, he also gives the example of the demon who represents what causes or was put in the Bhagavatam to demonstrate that obstacle. So the obstacle you refer to was represented by Putana. And the way it's described, by Srila Bhaktivedanta Saraswati Thakur, in answer to all 18 obstacles, when he begins in his introduction, is that the underlying drive, perseverance, determination, motivation, patience, all these things for the devotee, Kanishtha and on, is greed, simply desire. In other words, that is the one thing that can never be overcome. As long as you have this greed for advancing in spiritual life, then in this case, or as you put it, nothing, all these obstacles will be dissipated at some point in time, in that lifetime, possible in that lifetime. So I just wanted to make that point. This Krishna Samvid, which I had just now getting familiar with, is quite incredible. My question is, and that's, I always have the problem within Srimad Bhagavatam, and that is, your main point is on motivation. We have Marichchitraketu, which is supposed to be a more or less a Rajarshi king, right? And you refer to him having the mode of passion, because he is...
I referred to Dhruva Maharaj.
To Dhruva Maharaj. I thought, but also you meant that Chitraketu...
In the sense that he didn't have any sons.
Yeah, but in other words, he's feeling, what's the word? He's agitated by the fact that there's no sons.
Hmm.
So it's hard to comprehend or reconcile, as going on the right. How is it that he should be feeling this way? And also, that's my first part of my question. And the second part of my question, since the whole idea of the Bhagavatam is Nitya Bhakti Sevayam in relationship to Krishna, how is, one, that concept as applied to Chitraketu? And second of all, how is it applied to us understanding the, you know, Krishna's interaction in that whole affair?
Well, even pure devotees, you know, are put into circumstances. Of course, if they're pure devotees, they're put into those circumstances by Krishna to illustrate the danger of the mode of passion. You know. Otherwise, a pure devotee, especially a king, you know, he still has to be a king. And to be a king, you have to, you know, have great amount of passion. And so to control that passion, sometimes Krishna takes his pure devotee and puts him in a circumstance where he's, you know, by the internal energy, he's inspired to, this mode of passion overcomes him. Just like Arjuna, he was overcome through the internal energy. He demonstrated symptoms of the mode of ignorance. Srila Prabhupada begins in the, lamentation. And in the beginning of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. But this is all being done by Yoga Maya. So if a devotee is actually a pure devotee, they may be used by... That's why pure devotional service is very wonderful, but it's also very demanding. Otherwise, Krishna puts his... Once one actually comes to the platform of pure devotional service, we can see in so many instances that Krishna uses that devotee, puts him into very difficult circumstances, very trying circumstances. The Pandavas, you know, exiled, treated so badly, to the point where Bhishma was crying when he saw them on his deathbed. Well, you know, you have gone through so much. Krishna put you through so. Who can understand? You know, this is the action and the interaction of eternal time. So he was explaining that. Who can understand why Krishna is doing this to his devotees? But what he's doing is demonstrating to everybody else how the devotee goes beyond or overcomes the very, very difficult circumstances that anyone may be subjected to according to their karma. Where it may appear that the devotee is just being overcome as anyone else, he's used to give that example how you go beyond that circumstance. So Chitraketu, in his case, he was lamenting. He didn't have a son. No, of course, he was a king. A king has to have a son. Dasharatha was also lamenting that he didn't have a son. No. because he was a king, and a king has to have a son. You have to carry on the dynasty. Your duty is to carry on the kingdom. So, but the fruit of his lamentation was Harshashoka. When, after Harshashoka left, he was instructed, but we were all instructed through him, you know, that what is the nature of material energy? What is the nature of family? What is the nature of friendship? What is the nature of attachment? And Chitraketu, and then he fully understood, to the point where when he was cursed by Parvati, he had no trace of the modes of nature. He simply accepted it and was smiling. And Parvati couldn't even understand it. How? I just cursed him to become a demon, you know? And he's smiling, accepting it, bowing his head to me. You know? So there was a circumstance, and then there was this demonstration of the highest degree of humility. Tama Harpagu.
Just bring it
to okay.
So how do I bring Krishna Bhagavatam Stavyam? How do I understand all these stories in the taste that's leading us in the 10th canto, et cetera, et cetera? Then you say, what is, I want to say, what's the essence in relationship now? I understand completely your answer was divine. But now, how do I understand Krishna's personal involvement in this concept?
Krishna's personal involvement?
Yeah, how do I connect? Because that's the whole point that Narada Muni is telling you about us to write the Bhagavatam. I'm always having confusion. Now let me bring it to this ultimate understanding. You clarify the whole theme.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But how, so how does it come to Krishna?
Yeah.
Well, it does, because all these great devotees are devotees of Vishnu, and Vishnu, Lord Vishnu has a personal intervention in their lives. You know? I mean, after they go through this trying circumstance, Lord Vishnu blesses them. You know? And then, of course, it all ultimately comes to the point of Krishna. First we have to understand Vishnu, then we understand Krishna. So, Tamahar Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you very much, Maharaj. I think the central point that I got out of this class was that our motivation and our connection with the lower modes of nature are best overcome through association with advanced mm-hmm. devotees. And you gave such a nice example of Dhruva Maharaj, who, of course, his becoming overcome by the mode of passion was when he started killing the Yakshas in retaliation for killing his brother. And he was, you know, he overdid it and began slaughtering them, mm-hmm. of course. And then it's interesting that Swayambhu Vamanu then came to him. Was it Swayambhu Vamanu?
Yeah.
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, he was the first.
And gave him good instruction, and he immediately stopped. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, kind of in answer to that question, what's the difference between these are supposed to be great devotees or pure devotees, but then they seem to be connected with the modes of nature. One thing, of course, your answer was this is part of the pastime for our instruction. But also part of the instruction is that they immediately respond to higher authority. Mm-hmm. When they're given good instruction, they immediately come to their pure position, devotional service, where a lesser personality would not take good instruction.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you very much. Mahatma.
You know, a similar question was asked to Prabhupada when Arjun's son, Abhimanyu, was killed. Arjun was lamenting. And so this man said, Arjun's a pure devotee and he's lamenting. And Prabhupada said, well, it's natural if your son is killed, you lament. This man couldn't put it together. And then Prabhupada said, but he never gave up his duty. Mm-hmm. So that was Prabhupada's answer. So even though he was in that situation, so similar to what Tamahar is saying. So he was lament, you know. So there's kind of this reality, okay, you're a pure devotee, there are different levels. There may be some setback in your life, some disturbance. You know, Prabhupada sometimes would say, I'm so disturbed I can't translate. One time, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was in Bombay and said, Prabhupada, I'm so disturbed I can't chant because of what was going on. Prabhupada said, me too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the material world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's stories like that where some devotees said, Prabhupada, it's so difficult to control my senses, what I do. And Prabhupada said, I know, I also have a tongue. So there is that, but you know, then there's the duty. You know, they just it's that's the bhakti. You know, just despite all this, they're doing it. They're going on.
Yes, very good point. Thank you very much.
Any more? Thank you so much. I have so many questions that, you know, we can talk, you know, probably a whole afternoon about. Wonderful class. As a father, as a parent, sometimes I feel that I have, in my experience, you know, that I have to use a little bit of the mode of passion in order for my kids to listen to me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in the mode of goodness, you know, like we say in my country, you give the hand and they take your elbow. Mm-hmm. So, also one time, you know, when Srila Prabhupada went to a temple and the temple president was complaining to Srila Prabhupada about the cook, you know, because he has having issues with the cook. And he's complaining about the cook, and they say so passionate. Then Prabhupada says, yeah, that's why the prasad in this temple is so good. So we know that utilizing the passion in the Krishna service is allowed. So mm-hmm. I have a problem, you know, because, you know, I have passion. And I've been feeling that somehow or another Srila Prabhupada is ringing the bell in so many instances in my life, because since I was a kid I have contact with the ISKCON society. And due to the mismanagement of certain things, you know, many things happening in our society. And how do you somehow or another, without committing offenses, because as soon you speak with a little bit of force or maybe sentiment, then you brand it as you're criticizing or you're too passionate, Prabhu. But, you know, it's been more than 25, 30 years that, so, and also you're talking about the goal, which is obviously to serve the Acharya, and association is so important. But we're seeing that many people, you know, don't think that within ISKCON that association is sufficient, and they're going outside of our movement to look for that association. How do somebody like myself that, you know, have this type of passion in myself and in my blood can do some service in trying to tell people, listen, this is what Srila Prabhupada said, don't go outside for outside association, remain within ISKCON without sounding offensive, critical, or passionate.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure I want to embark on that subject matter, because that can evolve into a very long discussion. But each devotee, each person is inspired in a certain way, you know? And of course Srila Prabhupada wanted everybody to be in his movement, and many people, different people may have different ideas of how to be in the movement, so, or how to serve the movement, or how, or that they are in the movement but they're taking some shiksha. So there are many different understandings of, you know, I need some shiksha, I need this, I found an inspiration here, but I'm still serving. So the essence of being in ISKCON is to follow Srila Prabhupada, you know, as the founder Acharya, and to perform devotional service according to the way that Srila Prabhupada indicated for us to do so. You know. And, you know, because when you come to that question, then you have to, I personally think that it's something that has to be considered on a very individual level. Otherwise, if somebody does go outside, why, you know, if you really want to deal with that question, I don't know if you can deal with it just categorically, that no one should do it, because then we have to analyze what was their motivation for doing such a thing. No. So, but for one being labeled as passionate because you're trying to give the indication that one should not do it, well then, that also requires an analysis. You know? Was I too passionate? Should I have just, you know, with this particular person, not entered so much and not become overcome by anger or criticize them? I think that, again, I say it's a very, very, very complex issue. You know, a very complex issue. Certainly, Prabhupada wanted us all to serve, you know, in this society, which he, a house which he built in which everyone should live. No, but then we have, there's so many considerations. And I think it has to be done more on an individual basis rather than categorically one statement that everyone must be in this movement no matter what, and if they're not, you know, they're not obeying Srila Prabhupada. Because I've heard many, many different things, and there's some logic there, you know. Obviously, I've made the choice to be here in all aspects, and so many other devotees have done so, and this is what we feel is right. So therefore, I think the biggest argument for that is to be situated in ISKCON, be blissful, and continue to advance in devotional service. That's the strongest argument. Rather than, you know, why did you do this? And, you know, I do this, you do this, why did you do this? And, you know, that's something can be done on an individual basis, but I think just to do it categorically may be a bit shallow. And the best example is one's own actions. Actions speak louder than words. Going to an American saying. You know.
In spiritual life, then we can consider the activity. If it's unfavorable for our spiritual life, in where we could make some offense, opera, something that would set us back, then it's unfavorable, we should avoid it.
Mm.
So we have these six principles of Sharanagati, which actually is the main source, the underlying source for the Vaishnava, to make a determination of right and wrong. Because we don't, who knows what right or wrong unless we always can go to the guru and say Zadasang and like he's asking, and then, you know, so we can't always have that available, but we do have the six principles that are available. So,
okay, so I think on that note we'll stop here. All glory to Shri Guru, Shri Gauranga, Shri Prabhupada ki. Shri Radha Shama Sundar ki, Shri Krishna Balaram ki, Shri Gaur Nitai ki, Jaya Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki, Jaya.